Hi there, Greg Van Beek. This is Nancy O'Dell, and I wanted to say congratulations on 500 episodes of Nostalgia Radio Time. That is awesome. And you're also celebrating 10 years. I mean, that's quite the anniversary. Very impressive, Greg. I love me some oldies but goodies.
Once I had a secret love. Ha, I'm Lori Morgan, and if you love pop standards as much as I do, you'll want to tune in each week to Nostalgia Radio Time, hosted by my friend Greg Van Beek.
Go, Joe, go!
Hi everyone, this is Katie Couric, and I want to welcome you to one of my favorite programs, Nostalgia Radio Time, hosted by my friend Greg Van Beek.
Thank you, Katie Couric, and welcome to show number 585 of Nostalgia Radio Time.
Did you ever hear Bob Crane's show?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
Who is he anyway?
Bob Crane?
Yeah. His family? What's his background?
Well, he's a kid that was born in the slums.
And yes.
He never had a chance. He came to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my sister-in-law knows him. She says he's like he is on the A's, a sweet guy.
Yeah.
And you think desperately of something to say to him because all he has is his background
all he
to
knows,
talk about. You know,
yes. And
his poverty, you know. So what can you do with a guy?
That's
but
so wonderful.
Tries.
When these poor kids make a place for themselves.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. Because you take your average kid who has had
everything.
He's not going to try to be a disc jockey.
No.
He's not going to make that long climb.
No.
Why should he?
These people are driven by their own,
urge.
Insecurity.
Yeah. It comes out of ambition, but it's insecurity as far as I'm concerned.
Can I have another cup of coffee?
Yeah.
Well, I'm joined today on Nostalgia Radio Time by Carol Ford and Linda Groundwater. Carol, along with Linda, have authored a definitive biography of Bob Crane, whom most everyone knows for his role as Colonel Robert Hogan on the hit TV series Hogan's Heroes. But there's so much more to Bob's life and career than just that TV show, and Carol and Linda are going to enlighten all of us on what a truly gifted man he was.
Thanks for having us along.
Yes, thanks, Greg.
Glad to have you. And now Bob actually began as a musician when he was a very young lad growing up in Connecticut. Is that right?
Yes, it sure
it
is. Yeah, he first started drumming when he was about 10 or 11 years old. He went to the 1939 World's Fair, saw Gene Krupa playing at the 1939 World's Fair, and that was just it. He wanted to be a drummer. And so from that point on, he was drumming. He had carried his drumsticks with him everywhere. His friends in school, they called him Stamford's drummer boy. He was born in Waterbury, Connecticut, but he grew up in Stamford, Connecticut. And he went to Stamford High School, graduated from Stamford High School, played in the marching band. He fronted his own jazz band through the school. And from there, he really developed his interest in music that then led to his career in radio. In 1946, when he graduated from high school, the big band era was coming to an end. And he realized that he kind of missed his opportunity, sadly, to get in with any of the name bands or to even have his own name band the way, say, Tommy Dorsey or Buddy Rich or any of your big band era performers, band leaders. And so in order to stay close to the music that he loved so much, that's when he turned his sights to radio. And you saw that kind of coming towards the end of his high school years, because he was actually putting on mock radio shows in his bedroom for his best friend and his future wife, his first wife, Anne. And so he was very hooked into all of that right from the get-go.
Sure. Well, it really was about 1950 when he began what amounted to be a very successful career in radio for nearly 15 years. So why don't you give us a rundown on Bob's radio career, where it began and where it ended, and some of the highlights in between.
I'll give you the very beginning, which was most inauspicious. Bob had, as Carol said, long been interested in radio. And even on his honeymoon to the Poconos, he was going to radio stations to put in his air check to see if he could get a job or whatnot. And of course, it didn't quite happen then. But at one stage, shortly into his marriage, he saw a job at WLEA Radio in Hornell, New York. And he said, I'm going to go down and I'm going to get this job. And this is probably one of those favorite stories of mine. And Bob was determined that he was going to step into radio as soon as he could. And to his family's credit, particularly to Anne's at that stage, very supportive. Radio then, you know, was probably not the largest moneymaker, but it was what Bob really wanted, and his family supported him. So Anne said, go and do this. So Bob headed down from Connecticut to go to Hornell, New York. And along the way, this young couple's vehicle, which wasn't in the greatest shape, broke down. And Bob was going to miss this interview, and he really didn't want to miss this interview. So he hitched a ride on a horse and wagon that still had, you know, hay and all sorts of farmyard things sitting on the back. So he turned up at the radio station with hay and straw sticking out of his suit. And here's this tall, gangly kid going, I really need to be here. And he sat down for the interview and he said, when do I get on the air? And the interviewer said, I don't know what you're talking about. We need a maintenance man. I'd like you to push the broom. Would you like that job? And Bob said yes. And Bob took the job, and very shortly thereafter still ended up on the air. And he spent his time at the YMCA heating up soup, you know, in a can and sticking milk out on the windowsill to stay cool, and spending his week learning radio and then going home to Anne on the weekend. So that was his big beginning. That was Bob's big break. But in the end, it really was a big break for him because it led to so many other things.
Sure. And I guess he was known as the king of Los Angeles airwaves in the early 1960s. And I read that he actually had Marilyn Monroe and Frank Sinatra on his show. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. He did. And it's funny. It's, yeah, thousands and thousands of celebrities, prominent people in the industry, in the entertainment industry. He said he had everybody from, you know, the janitor to the kid who shines your shoes, and, you know, he had a chimpanzee on once. You know, so he was interviewing everybody at that time. But before he got to that point, he really had to invent a radio show that was going to get him noticed. And going back to WLEA, that's where that all started. He was, he was listening to all different kinds of radio shows throughout his young life at that point. And he was taking note of what he thought worked. And he was also taking note of what he really didn't like and what he felt didn't work. And as he was going through, he was thinking, well, you know, what if when I read this ad for, you know, a product or a service, what if I were to add a little bit of sound effects? And so he started off in Hornell, New York with Borden's milk. And he would take a little salt shaker and he would have a little glass of water and he would fill the salt shaker with water. And he would say, you know, Borden's milk is so fresh. Why, we're milking the cow right here in the studio. And he would take the salt shaker and he'd start dripping it into the water, and it would sound like water, you know, milk. He was actually milking the cow. And then, you know, all the magic of radio, what you don't see, your imagination fills in the blanks for. And right. So then he would say, well, the milk is fresh. Well, the eggs are fresh too. And he would have, he had this chicken, this cackling chicken that he kept all the way straight through his whole radio career. But he would say, here, the eggs are fresh too. And there would be this plop sound. And so he did that, and he was experimenting and he wasn't getting any real pushback at the time. And so he said, well, if I can do sound effects, then why not voices? So then that's when he started doing some voices. Voice impersonations. He became known as KNX's Man of 1,000 Voices because he could do so many. But all of this led to him building a radio show that then, by the time he gets out to Los Angeles and he spends 4 or 5 years at KNX, they say, you know, you're so good. Let's add something to your show. And then that becomes the, you know, the celebrity interview component. And he was the only radio personality doing celebrity live unrehearsed celebrity interviews daily for the good portion of 5 years out there.
And wow, a really important thing, I think, if I may just tag on to what Carol said, is we hear these things. And if you think in terms of, you know, the late 20th century, early 21st century, that all sounds pretty common. You know, you have your morning jocks. And I mean, I used to do radio. You had your morning crew and, you know, you have your interviews and your sound effects and all this stuff. Back in the 1950s, nobody was doing that. You know, there's a reason that they called Bob a radio genius. Even the people who didn't care for Bob as a person acknowledged his absolute genius in radio. They would actually, KNX actually sold Bob's advertising time with a premium if you wanted him to play with the ads. Who does that? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Who does that? And when they wanted to get people interested in the station, they would bring them into the station to watch him on the air. Now, anyone who's been in a radio station would know, but for those who haven't, you know, you've got these soundproof booths and a big window in the front. Like, I was on the news side, so I know that I was always looking at the jock through a window and everybody was signaling madly, you know, but you'd never heard anything. And they would bring people in to watch Bob in between him and his engineer, and they would watch, but that's a whole story on its own that Carol can probably inform me about later. But they would bring him in and he would have hundreds, if not thousands, of records in the radio station in his booth. And if he wanted a sound effect and something just occurred to him, they said they had never seen anyone before or since who could simply reach up into a stack in what seemed like seconds, grab a record, toss it on the turntable, put himself exactly where he wanted that needle to be. And within seconds, he had the sound effect he needed to go into the ad, to go into the conversation that was playing. And all of that was a premium and so different. And so they sold that.
And they bundled it. They bundled it too. So you could not just buy advertising time on Bob's show. So Bob's show was from 6 to 9 a.m. You bought spot on his show, say, you know, wherever it was, you had to buy time in one or two other spots. You could not just buy time during Bob's spot. So not only was there a premium, he was also bundled. That is how successful, that is how popular he was. And that's how much money he made for KNX. Tons of money for KNX.
Loads of money for KNX. And when they wanted him to go out and do events, he would carry this little tape recorder with him that had little sound effects and things in it, because Bob Crane would never come and speak. Yeah. If you wanted to have Bob Crane, it was because you got all the things that went with it. So he'd carry around this, imagine in those days, you know, this tape recorder that's probably about a foot and a half.
It was wide. The reel to reel. It was the whole reel to reel setup. Yeah, that he would
and
have.
He'd bring it and he'd play with it and he would do his show, a little mini version of his show live, talking to people in the audience about the things that were going on in the audience. It was absolutely improv. It was amazing. He was just the word genius has been said by many people to us. We didn't prompt it. We promise. It was just, he was a radio genius. You have to accept it. And when you look at what he did and the time that he did it in, as in the late 50s, early 60s, you cannot ignore how he literally changed the face of radio.
Absolutely. Well,
he was a pioneer in it, because what you were describing with the records and the sound effects, I mean, that took some skill. Today, it's all digital. It's
on the computer. Yeah.
The button and there it is. You want to applause or laughter or whatever. There it is.
There it is.
Then after the radio, the acting bug hit. I think in the early 1960s, he had roles on several notable TV series like Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Dick Van Dyke Show, Donna Reed, and he had a reoccurring role on Donna Reed, I think, as playing a doctor.
Yeah, it's important to say that all of that started after he had been with KNX for 5 years. And there's a reason for that. when he went out to Hollywood and he signed his first contract with KNX, it was a 5-year contract. And there was a specific no acting clause. He could not act professionally in anything for that duration of that contract. Now, they put that in there, and I would imagine they put it in with others. I think they did tell us that some of the folks that worked at KNX with Bob at the time, some of the sales guys, because they didn't want to have him come out, stay there for a year. It's Hollywood. He's a good looking guy. He's talented. He could very easily drift right off into the sunset, and KNX is now at, without their radio guy. That they
well, they were
just
losing
lured.
Ralph's story. You know, well, Ralph's story was right. Going off to do the $64,000 question. That's how Bob, that's how that opening appeared for Bob in the first place. So KNX was no stranger to,
that's
hey,
right.
Here's your disc jockey. Goodbye. You know.
So when as Bob became more successful, because he wasn't a dynamic hit right out of the gate, Ralph's story was a much different morning person on the radio. He was more subdued. He had a much slower way of speaking. He was a storyteller. No pun on his name, but he would tell these stories during his radio show and kind of lull people awake, you might say, in the morning. It was a slow waking up. When Bob came on the air, it was like shattered glass, you know, it was like, you know, loud and, you know, crazy, you know, you were going to launch out of bed when that came on the air. And so at first, audiences and the sales guys, they really didn't know what to think about it. But as time went on, he did become more and more popular. And by about 1959 or so, he starts to really want to break into acting. So he starts looking at community theater. He's doing a couple of plays, Tunnel of Love, and you know, just
who was that lady?
Who was that lady I saw you with? Mm-hmm. That's right. And they were just little local plays, and he would promote them on the air on his show, and he would say, you know, maybe three people will come and see me, and you know, and make jokes about it. But he really wanted to get into the acting. He saw Gig Young in Tunnel of Love. And he and his first wife, Anne, came out of the theater after seeing Tunnel of Love. And Anne says to him, I just spent the last hour and a half watching you. And that was just kind of it. He wanted to be the next Jack Lemmon, the next Gig Young. And so he started down that road, but he was confined to this no acting in his contract. Mm-hmm. He had a little bit part in a tiny pilot episode called Picture Window that never made it. Max Schulman from Dobie Gillis. He did this 60-second pilot spot for that. Didn't go anywhere. But it's when that no acting clause gets lifted after the 5-year contract. That's when you see him start to appear in different things. The Alfred Hitchcock Hour. You see him then go on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And it's on the Dick Van Dyke Show that Donna Reed notices him, and she has him come on as a guest first off. And then he did so well as the guest in the one episode that he was asked to come back for a recurring supporting role.
Okay. So that was kind of a springboard to what everybody knows him best for, Hogan's Heroes. That must have come on. Too much longer after Donna Reed.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it's important to note that Bob left Donna Reed because he wanted to leave Donna Reed.
Okay.
Bob wasn't fired from the Donna Reed show. You know, there's all this talk that he was fired because he was too this and too that. And he was not. Bob said, this is a nice show, but it's, you know,
I'm bored.
Husband, wife, father knows best. You know, leave it to Beaver. It's all, it is. And Bob was not known for being one of those ordinary meat and potatoes guys when it came to his work. He liked something a little different. So he had opportunities to do other shows, you know, Please Don't Eat the Daisies, and was it My Mother the Car? Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, and he just said no. And then somebody came to him one day and said, hey, I got something different. How about a POW camp? And he went, what? That sounds different, but scary. And so that one caught his eye. And Bob spent quite a bit of time thinking about whether this was a show that he wanted to do, not because it was different, but because of the subject matter. Because it was about World War II. Bob's brother was in the war. He was on the USS Bunker Hill and his ship was kamikaze attacked and his brother barely made it out. And he was very sensitive to veterans issues and those things. So Bob's cousin told us, and I think we'd also heard from a few other sources, that Bob was very concerned about whether this was something that he should do. And so he made sure that he got feedback from POWs and veterans and said, how do you think? How do you feel about this? What do you think about this? Does this hurt you? And the POWs were so behind it, saying, look, if we didn't have a sense of humor, we never would have gotten out of those POW camps. So yes, this is funny. And Bob made a very important distinction, which was, we're not saying, look how horrible the Germans are. We're saying, look how clever the Allies are. So if you put the focus on the Allies instead of on the Germans, then although the Germans do look like buffoons, they only look like buffoons because of how clever the heroes are. And although they did have a lot of trouble in the beginning with people not understanding the difference between a POW camp and a concentration camp, when you consider that at least four or five of the main people involved in the cast were Jewish or who had escaped from Europe as part of the under the Nazi regime, if those people could tell the difference, then certainly the audience should be able to. And they made sure that they made it as clear as they could that this was, you know, this was about the POWs and it was about something being different. And it turned out to be the best thing Bob ever did for his career.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Hogan's Heroes ran from 1965 to 71, and it was produced by Bing Crosby Productions. And I'm sure that you're both familiar with the Christmas episode of the ABC variety series, The Hollywood Palace, that Bing hosted. And he had the cast of Hogan's Heroes on as guests, first in costume, and later they were in formal wear singing Christmas carols with Bing Crosby.
If the boss wants you, you go.
That's right. They're bingo.
Say, that looks like the boys from Hogan's Heroes. They're tunneling their way home, I guess. Well, they better hurry. They have a long way to go. I think that's Bob Crane there. And Colonel Plink isn't even in sight.
Hold it a minute.
Man, you sure got there in a hurry all the way from Germany in 30 seconds.
We didn't think we were going to make it at all. Hey, fellas, I think we dug a little bit too far west.
Yeah, we're in a theater.
You sure are. You know where you are? You're right in the middle of a variety show here.
Hey, he must be Ed Sullivan.
I can't be. He's breathing.
It's a pleasure to have you fellas on the show, the members of one of the new hit shows of the season. It's a joy and a pleasure to have you with us on Hollywood Palace. And welcome.
Hollywood Palace?
Yeah. Who are you? Name's Crosby.
Oh, yeah, Gary. What happened? You look sick.
I'm Dennis. Forget about it.
Hey, fellas, I got news for you. This is the boss. This is the man that owns our show, Bing Crosby.
As you were. Come on. Bon day, maman.
That's the owner? I didn't know that.
Oh, come on. Didn't you ever see the end of the show where it says this has been a Bing Crosby production?
Yeah, but I thought that just meant he had another baby.
Okay, well, getting back to Bob Crane, it has happened so often when an actor is on TV so closely associated with a character, it seems that he was never really able to achieve the same degree of success in subsequent roles. He was forever thought of as Colonel Hogan. Tell us a bit about his work after Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, he was definitely typecast. And part of that is, you know, it's kind of the era too. The shows, the producers, I mean, look at Gilligan's Island, look at some of these. When they were going out to do promotions about the series, they would dress their lead actors up in their costumes. And so you have Gilligan going off to the supermarket and doing a ribbon cutting. So in the same sense, you have Hogan showing up everywhere in his Hogan uniform. Bob told the story once that early on, before the show was even on television, they were doing some promo things, and Bob was in his whole World War II, you know, leather jacket, brown pants, sitting in, I think it was a train station or a bus terminal, in his full garb. And of course, that's not what Air Force officers were wearing in 1965, 60, you know, they're wearing blues, you know, they're not wearing the browns like they were in World War II. And they, I guess some of these officers walked by Bob and saw him, not realizing that he was an actor, not realizing that this was for a promo shoot, and going, wow, you know, he's really behind the times as they walked by, because he obviously was in the right uniform, but not in the right time. So he was typecast. And in the beginning, he really embraced that whole image of Hogan. He loved being Hogan. But by the end, he was getting very frustrated because, and I'm not an actor, Linda is an actor. So Linda can understand this. But, you know, he wanted to be known as an actor who was working in and doing different things, whether it was a dramatic role, whether it was a comedy role. And people were saying, hey, look, there's Hogan, there's Hogan. And he would say, my name's Bob Crane. My name's Bob Crane. And so it was starting at the end of the series to hinder him. When the series ends, which it ended after 6 seasons, it was supposed to go 7 seasons, but it was canceled during what has now become known as the Rural Purge, when CBS went through and swept through and just canceled a lot of their shows to make room for things like All in the Family and things of that nature. He had just the hardest time being cast because even the casting directors, even directors and producers would look at him and say, oh, we're hiring Hogan to fill this role. And what happens is then as he moves into the Bob Crane show, which was from, it was a mid-season replacement in 1975, early 1975, and I'll pass this over to Linda, and she can continue with this as she has more on this. But he really struggled with just breaking out of that typecast, moving into something that was completely different from Hogan, and audiences had a hard time accepting that character on the Bob Crane show.
Sure. I mean, imagine having Colonel Hogan as an insurance man. And that, you know, you can't put those two together and say the dynamics of the Hogan character were so powerful and strong, and the character was a hero and he was a leader and he was clever and he was in your face every week. And some people said Bob was playing himself. That really bothered him. He was acting and he worked really hard at his acting. And that's how, I mean, as an actor, when you study well, I mean, it's supposed to seem seamless. It's supposed to look like you're playing yourself. But he didn't walk off the set and wander around in his hero jacket and cap and say, excuse me, LeBeau, and excuse me, Commandant. And, you know, he was a separate, he was in completely different, he'd go home and he'd have dinner with his kids and, you know, get ready for the next day. And he, you know, but if you're doing it well, people see that character. But as Carol said, I mean, even with, say, Bing Crosby, they went on to the Bing Crosby show dressed in their heroes costumes. When does that happen? Like, they did a skit in character, and when they went to different shows, it was always in skit, you know, skits or bits in character, so that the audiences really only saw Colonel Hogan. And then, yes, they'd see Colonel Hogan play the drums or do this, but they were still seeing what I just said, Colonel Hogan playing the drums, Colonel Hogan standing next to Bing Crosby. Even if he was out of uniform at that point, the setup was, here he is as Colonel Hogan, and now he's someone else. And people can't and could not adjust to that well. I mean, even akin to, say, the Monkees. They got off the TV series The Monkees and went off to do other acting. And they said, for instance, to Mickey Dolenz, well, you're a drummer. And he said, no, I'm not. I was an actor. I had my own TV show. And they said, no. So when he went to apply for jobs, they said, oh, but you're not an actor. You're a drummer. Bob Crane, you can't be an insurance man or a doctor a detective or whatever. You're Colonel Hogan. And he wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it's very frustrating to actors to do that. But having said that, I will be fair and say that because he did it so well, there's a blessing and a curse to doing it so well. The blessing, of course, is that audiences completely accept you as that character. The curse is that they have a hard time accepting you as anything else. Right. And Bob did have that happen to him.
Sure. I will just quickly follow up on that too, is that it usually takes, so you look at what Bob is doing in the 1960s, early 1970s on Hogan's Heroes. That could have been anybody. That could have been any actor in that role. And we see that with other actors. You know, I was asked this question not too long ago. You know, like look at Richard Dean Anderson on MacGyver, you know, fast forwarding. You've got him as MacGyver, but then you stretch it out for many, many years and he shows up on Stargate and he's able to do a completely different character on Stargate SG-1 than he was on MacGyver. Two opposite ends of the spectrum. MacGyver won't touch a gun. Yes, big gap. And that is the thing that when you look at Bob, he ends Hogan's Heroes in 1971. By the time we get to 1978, which is the year he died, he is starting to finally break away from that typecasting. And you can see that in his acting, specifically on The Love Boat, where he plays a very dramatic character, where his character cries. And it's a very touching character scene where, you know, he's really digging in into those types of roles. And then suddenly he dies. So I would like to think that had he lived, once he got into the 1980s, he would have had a whole bounty of TV shows that he could have excelled in, because enough time would have been behind him from Hogan's Heroes. And you have all of these great ensemble shows that crop up. You have Cheers, you have Night Court, you have all of these shows that are really, you know, things that he would have enjoyed doing. And at that point, enough time has gone by. He just didn't get that time behind him because he was killed in 1978.
And his skill, like his talent as an actor, but his skill as an actor, and there is a difference between talent and skill, if you can take the very subtle difference. I'm an actor and I have some talent. I don't have the level of skill, for instance, that Bob has, because he's trained and Bob was always learning. And Bob's mantra was learn, learn, learn. And he would say that in when he was talking to his cousin about his cousin's own radio career. He would say that when he was in his own classes. Bob was willing to learn from everyone, whether it was something he wanted to do or something he didn't want to do. He could learn from both sides of that. But he had that level of skill and talent, and he had that charismatic presence that he could have carried off something else in the future if he just had the time. The problem was that he didn't have that time given to him. So even when you get to, for instance, The Love Boat, you've got people saying, oh, that was terrible. He was crying and Colonel Hogan was crying. No, Colonel Hogan wasn't crying. Bob Crane was playing a completely different character who had lost his daughter and he was crying. That's a different character to Colonel Hogan. But because syndication was huge and it was a very short time later, people could not break out of that. And now, because he's frozen in that time period, that's all they're ever going to see. There have been people say, oh, he's not that great an actor. Look, he couldn't do that because it was, you know, it was Colonel Hogan doing that. No, that's in our mind, not in his and not on the celluloid. It was just the way it appeared to us.
Well, I think a perfect example of what you're talking about, I can think of two instances where actors had a very successful career in one series and another series, and that's All in the Family that you mentioned, Carol O'Connor in that series, and In the Heat of the Night.
Yes, you're right. Yes, absolutely.
Complete opposite roles, but he's very successful in both of them. And the other one would be Andy Griffith, the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Right. Right. Yes. Yeah.
And William Shatner.
Absolutely. Yeah.
William Shatner. I mean, goodness. Denny Crane.
Michael Landon. We have Michael Landon on Little House on the Prairie, and then we fast forward to Highway to Heaven.
Little House.
Bonanza, right.
Angels, completely different characters, but they all had, all those actors had time for people
time
to get between. Used to, get used to that. And for instance, say with, Andy Griffith, suppose you discovered him in Matlock. I mean, even Buddy Ebsen went off to do his thing after. He wasn't Jed Clampett forever, but suppose you discovered Andy Griffith and Matlock, and suddenly you start to see these other, you know, the Andy Griffith Show come up, and you go, oh, look, oh, he did that too. People are looking at it from the opposite direction. And given time, if people had discovered Bob on television or movies later in his career, then it would have been, oh, look, this is where he started in Hogan's Heroes. And they would have a completely different perspective to what we have now.
Exactly. And I guess that leads us up to what I guess you could call the pink elephant in the room, because unfortunately today, Bob is equally as well known for his role in Hogan's Heroes as he was for the tragic murder that ended his life. And I guess the best way to handle this delicate topic is to let you set the record straight about your thoughts and the facts of the situation.
So... yeah, we get asked this all the time. It is the elephant in the room. Yeah. It is something that is glaring because there are two reasons. One, it is, you know, it's kind of a perfect storm. You have murder, you have sex, you have scandal, you have mystery because it's still unsolved. Mm-hmm. So you put all of these things together and it just creates a feeding frenzy. Unfortunately, that is all the low-hanging fruit, you might say. That is the stuff that everybody gravitates towards, and everybody thinks that he, without any kind of knowledge or understanding, Linda and Dee Young, who is our third author on the book, who also worked at WICC, she met Bob back in 1976. We have learned so much about Bob through all of these people who knew him personally and who were very important in his life. Because of that, we were able to understand what he came to understand as an addiction. Now, he was very promiscuous throughout his life, not just when he gets to Hollywood, but going all the way back to the 1950s in Bridgeport, Connecticut, when he was at WICC. So this is something that had been building on itself for quite a while. It's not he gets out to Hollywood and loses his mind and goes crazy because he can't handle fame. It's he is just building upon something that becomes an addiction. Now, it's important to say that it was, and we say this as these are the facts that we know and have been proven. He was having consensual sex with adult women only, who, when he asked, were willing participants in his amateur pornography. There was no drugs. It's not like Bill Cosby. It's not a Me Too thing. It is consensual. Unfortunately, that all gets lost in today's headlines and language. And people right away assume that, you know, he's doing, you know, illegal things or, you know, forcing or whatever. And that simply wasn't the case. We learned that he was coming to terms with this addiction shortly before the end of his life. We learned that he had confided in a counselor who spoke with us in great detail about Bob's decision to want to break free of this addiction. And he was taking those first steps towards recovery. Now, whether or not he would have succeeded, we will never know. But what is important to say is that he wanted to, and he was committing himself to doing that.
There are a couple of other things, too, to build on what Carol just said. Again, people think about these things in today's terms, and you can't. For one thing, sexual addiction is still something that people will giggle about. In those days, you could never mention it. You could never say you had any kind of people, you know, I still have hear people say online and whatnot, oh, I wish my wife had that kind of addiction. Ha, ha, ha. No, no, you really don't. And, you know, David Duchovny went off and apparently was cured in a weekend. That's not an addiction. An addiction isn't cured in a weekend by going, now don't you do that anymore. An addiction is an issue. And the counselor then he had confided in told us that this a sexual addiction is as strong and difficult as some of the harder drugs. It is playing on your physicality. And the longer you have this addiction, the harder it is for you to reach that same level of high or whatnot, the same as, you know, with cocaine or LSD or whatever these other drugs are. But when we look at it from today, we go, oh, you know, those women, they didn't know they were being recorded. Really? You know that radio behind you, Greg? The cameras would have been about that big. There was, and if you look at the, and if you look at the crime scene photos, if any woman didn't know she was being recorded, she'd have had to have been an absolute idiot. The cameras were bigger than your computer monitors. They were massive, and there was no pinhole cameras and phone cameras. There was a camera, and there were wires and cords and lights and noises. So people who say that it was not consensual have no idea and have never seen the women waving at the cameras because they knew they were being recorded. They were performing. And when Bob was killed, some of those women went to that same counselor and said, where are the tapes? They knew they were tapes. They were completely aware that there were tapes. The other thing here is that it's important to note that Bob was what I would call obsessive compulsive. Bob recorded everything in his life, the pornography, the sex. I would say, given the volume of what he recorded, may have been 5% of his entire life. But nobody's going to talk about the recording at the dinner table or the recording about them talking about the dentist appointment or the recording about what happened at school today. They're going to talk about the sex. But Bob recorded absolutely obsessively everything. And a psychologist would have a ball trying to figure this one out. But for example, if he had a diary and the diary said dentist at 2 p.m. and for some reason he didn't go, it would be crossed out and there would be a reason written there next to it why he didn't go. And then you would see the next appointment booked wherever it was and the outcome would be written in the diary.
Had a cavity.
Everything. Yeah. And the cavity in level two, you know, he recorded everything. So the focus is, of course, on the most sensual and scandalous. But the reality is it was just another part of his life when they talk about the recordings. And lastly, unlike what some people have said, he was not proud of this. You know, he liked sex and he'd openly admit that he liked sex. But if he liked sex and he was so proud of it, the 200 people that we spoke to would have known. And out of the 200 plus people that we spoke to, I think there were maybe three who had any inkling that this was happening in his life.
And if that's the case,
yeah. And if that's the case, then he certainly wasn't proud of it, because if you're proud of it, you're allowed it about it. And he was not. And so just for his own vindication, I suppose, Bob was an addict and he knew he was an addict and he knew that it was ruining his life. And it was responsible in part for the failure of his first marriage. He knew that it meant that he was failing in many ways as a father. And certainly was failing as a husband. And he was not proud of any of that. And for people to suggest that he was because they like the idea of a sex addiction is just, it's monstrous. How can people think that anybody would be so proud of that? But you have to look at it in that context of it was a very small part of a very large life. And we cannot look at it as we do in 2023. We have to look at it as what was possible in 1960s, 70s, you know, what was possible then, right. You know, and that was there and it was part of his Parthenon, wasn't it? And, yeah. Bob had a gentleman friend, Joe Cosgrove, who welcomed him to Los Angeles when he and his family came out in the mid to late 50s. And he said something that we have always, I have always found very touching. And he said, these things are like the specks on the Parthenon. And it's time to look at the Parthenon and not the speck.
And that's a very good point, because I think in a way you can compare Bob's life to JFK and his murder. You know, people are more focused on the manner in which he died than so much of what he accomplished during his life. And it's the same thing with Bob. You know, it was a tragic murder in both instances.
And what could he have done had that not happened? But because of the circumstances, those people, any of those, you know, murder victims or early deaths through accident or whatnot, they are locked in a period of time, and people will not allow them out of that. But that means that the speculation runs wild, because who's going to know?
Who's going to know what would happen?
You know, there's no way of knowing what Bob would have done. There's no way of knowing what JFK would have done. There's no, you know, there's no way of knowing what Martin Luther King would have done. None of that. Exactly. There's just no way. So people will speculate, and they'll pick it apart, and they'll make fun, and
they'll lie, and they will lie.
And they'll lie.
I'm going to jump in here and say that the movie that came out in 2002, directed by Paul Schrader, called Autofocus, has done a heap of damage. Because again, what it does is it just gravitates towards the sex, the scandal, and the murder. And anything that they could throw at the screen that could perpetuate this belief that Bob was this washed up, sad, depressed, brooding type of character who thanks his murderer at the end of the film, please thank you for killing me, I was, you know, pretty well done with everything anyway, is terrible. But they got so much wrong in this movie. And what is the most shocking thing of all, it's one thing to get something wrong because you're being lazy, or, you know, not that that makes it right. But Paul Schrader actually came out and told the New York Times, it was never my intent to be true or factual. The whole film is a distortion. You know, why, you know, John Carpenter, who is the man who, not to be clear, is not the same as the director, John Carpenter. So John Henry Carpenter, John Carpenter is not as important in Bob's life, in his actual life, as he is in the film. It's all a distortion. You know, I wanted to get at something meaty. Otherwise, who cares? People's lives, real lives, aren't important. Otherwise, who cares? Would you want to watch a film about Alan Hale? And that's, so he says these things to the New York Times. They're printed. And it's just astonishing to us that, you know, he jokes about it. I made stuff up. Yep, I made stuff up to make money.
Yeah, I character assassinated this person that I didn't know for no reason other than I thought it might make money. And God help me, I am so thrilled that that movie was an absolute flop. Because people that knew Bob saw this and were horrified. Horrified. Yes. And I can't imagine what that was like for his family. And it hurt them. When we started this project, when I started this project, one of the first people I encountered was Bob's cousin, Jim Senich, God rest his soul, beautiful man. And we just lost him last year. And he said, please, please, please help tell people that Bobby wasn't like they say he was. You know, he was a big teddy bear. And people think he walks around with horns sticking out of his head, but it's not true. And imagine knowing someone so well and loving them so much, and the world is saying something completely different to what you know to be true.
Yeah.
It's just, and with no excuse other than, well, you know, it was available, so I did it.
Right.
And that's why we did this book. We just went, well, we know that's not right. So somebody needs to tell the truth. So we're doing it.
And that's why, too, we keep coming on to shows like yours, Greg, because it's another place where we can talk about it. The book's been out since 2015, but it's still it still is important to continue to keep it front and center, as it is important to tell Bob's true story, because it gets so lost. We see the comments that come up. I mean, Linda and I just had a round with someone earlier this week who just was...
Watch just, autofocus. Just watch autofocus. Just watch please don't watch autofocus. It's full of lies. And they're like, well, how do you know? And I'm like, well, yeah. I'll tell you how we know.
It's fascinating because more people will see a movie than, unfortunately, they will read a book. And when
it's
Linda...
It's on audio.
Yeah. Oh, when Linda and I talk about Bob and say that, you know, we are Bob Crane's official biographers. Well, what makes you his official biographers? Well, we have the support and endorsement of his family and his estate. We've interviewed more than 200 people. We have spent decades researching him. You know, we are not his children who... have written or will are writing books from their perspective of growing up in a household with him. We are presenting an entire birth to death story, you know, his life that is broad, and it conveys the entire scope of his life to get to who he really was as a person. My dad worked at the airlines. I heard he was a very good worker, and I knew, and I'm very proud of him for what he did in the airline industry. But do I know everything he did while he was on the job? No, I do not, because how would I? I was six. So, you know, we have, you know, gotten all of those, all of that information, and we've compiled it. And that is what makes us his official biographers.
And we didn't set out to vindicate him.
Right.
We didn't set out. I mean, I know when I began and when I brought Carol into the fold, thank God, that I said to her, you know, we just want the truth. The good, the bad, the ugly. We didn't know what we were going to get, did we, Carol? We had idea what we were going to get. All we knew was that we weren't getting everything, and we needed to get everything. And I mean, there's a whole story behind what I would see and whatnot as I began, but the long and short of it is that I just went, nope, not getting a whole story. We need to get a whole story. I want to know the things that are like buried. They're not hidden, but they've all been buried under this sex and scandal. And I started around the time that crazy movie came out, so nobody would talk to us. Gee whiz, because guess what? They'd all been burned. So it was a very long process, a very difficult process. And all we said was, well, I just want to know the truth. And if the guy was a jerk, then that's what we're going to say. And there were a couple of people who went, you know what? I wasn't really thrilled with him, but here's my reality with him. And so although the book spins him very positively, the reason it spins that way is because that's what we were told. He wasn't so incredibly different from what you expected to see. It's just been overshadowed by his murder. And if he had not been murdered, we probably wouldn't know very much about his addiction, because he was hiding it and fighting it.
Yes. Well, I think just as a way of kind of wrapping up, let's give my listeners a little recap of your book, the title and where it can be had, where you can buy a copy of it, and how many pages it is. I think it's quite a long book.
It's quite big. I don't know if you can see it. It's pretty big. It's
650 pages, I think.
700, just under 700. Our publisher, AM Inc. Publishing, up in Massachusetts, he, Mike Aloisi is my publisher, and he gratefully let us publish the book we wanted to publish. The only thing I fought him on was the hardcover. I wanted a hardcover, but he did leave us, a lot of, room to write and publish the book that we wanted and get out to the public. So you can get the book, everything that we do for Bob, the book, the podcasts, you know, everything that we do, our social media is on our website, voteforbobcrane.org. That's vote4bobcrane.org. The book is available through my publisher's website, but also on Amazon. You can get it through Barnes and Noble. I've seen copies now popping up on eBay. You can get it pretty much anywhere. But on our website is kind of the hub for all things. You can find the book, you can find podcasts. When you're finished producing this interview, Greg, you'll find this interview on there too. we'll link right to it. but everything, the other thing that we make available too is a lot of Bob's radio work, because people know him as Colonel Hogan, but what they don't know so much is all of the work he did in radio. And we've been trying very hard to have him inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame. And that's been a challenge because, of course, all of what we have just been talking about overshadows all the good he did in radio. And, you know, it's okay for the Radio Hall of Fame to have others in there who could be considered questionable with as far as their personal. But we are trying very hard to have him inducted and honored in that. So voteforbobcrane.org is where you find everything. And the name of the book, again, is Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography.
Well, Carol and Linda, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with me about Bob. I certainly learned a great deal about him, and I'm sure my listeners have as well. And I want to wish you all the luck in the world in getting him inducted in the Radio Hall of Fame. It's certainly a well-deserved honor, and the best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Okay, thank you again.
Thank you.
Go, Joe, go!
And for more information on Nostalgia Radio Time, check us out on Facebook and Twitter. And if you have any comments about the program or like to make any requests, send them to nostalgiaradiotime@yahoo.com. I'm Greg Van Beek. Thank you for listening and hope you'll join me again next week. Until then, so long for now.